Bonsoir. Merci d'être ici ce soir, d'avoir accepté cette invitation de l'École d'environnement pour entendre notre invité, David Owen. Welcome to the MSc Public Lecture Series. I'm Sylvie Deblois. I'm the Interim Director of the McGill School of Environment. My colleague, Professor Kevin Manow, will introduce our speaker in a moment, but first I would just like to thank our generous donor, who is a McGill graduate and who is making this event possible. Her donation allows us to welcome world-class speakers, to engage in discussions, as we love to do at the School of Environment, and debates about important environmental issues. And many of the speakers that we had on these occasions have inspired us and challenged us also, and I think it's going to be the case also tonight with our guest speaker. So I'm going to let Kevin introduce David Owen, and thank you very much for being here. You may want to check your cell phone now.
Thanks, Sylvie, and welcome everyone to the first MSc Speaker Series of the year. We're very happy to have David Owen here to speak to us. And I'll just take a few minutes to introduce a little bit what he's about, and then I'll turn it over to him. And but surely he's one of the most eclectic and diverse authors I've come across in a while. He's been at the New Yorker magazine for the last roughly 25 years. Before that, he was an editor or lead writer at both Harper's and Atlantic Monthly. And on top of that, he's written over a dozen books on everything from golf to something that I'd love to hear more about later, but is he went undercover as a high school student for 4 months back in 1980, which I think and Barry Manilow was somehow involved. I think if you get a chance, you should ask him about it. But but the reason why we've invited him here for this is back in 2004, he wrote a piece in The New Yorker called Green Manhattan, which was in many ways kind of one of the first it was kind of this manifesto about what we think of as sustainable living and green living, and it really talked a lot about how cities, the role that cities can play in wider environmental issues. And that grew into two books, one called Green Metropolis and one called The Conundrum, which I think he'll be talking quite a bit about today. And just a quick kind of personal note, or when I was planning my Environmental 400 Environmental Thought course this semester, I was trying to find lots of different sources, and you know, from classics to historical environmental works to more modern works to more sort of philosophical works to more sort of concrete ideas and to more what you might call optimist and what we can say realist or dare I say pessimist, but I'll kind of let you make your own minds about where he's coming from here, but I chose this book, The Conundrum, in my course because it really sort of challenges, I think it challenges a lot of people's ideas about what sustainability is and isn't, and what works and what doesn't. And while some of the book maybe is little pessimistic, I think the first sort of step moving forward is understanding what has worked and what doesn't work and why. And so with that, I'll turn it over to. Oh, sorry, I think I preempted that, but I'll turn it over to David. Thanks a lot.
Thank you. And thank you, Kevin and Sylvie. And I wish I could respond in French, but I'm like my father. My parents were in Paris once, and my father, who was very proud of his high school French, struck up a conversation with a man sitting at the table next to him, and they had a great deal of difficulty talking to each other, my father and this Frenchman. And my mother finally realized that the Frenchman didn't realize that my father was speaking French, and my father didn't realize that the Frenchman was speaking English. And once they cleared that up, it was better. I can tell you just a very tiny bit about myself. I'm a journalist and not a scientist or an economist, and I've done a lot of different things. And one assignment for The New Yorker a couple of years ago took me to South America for the first time. I went to Colombia, and on my first day in Bogota, two women in an old Toyota picked me up at my hotel and took me to a warehouse in a kind of industrial park on the outskirts of the city. And there, inside this warehouse, The man that I had come to interview shot me in the stomach with a 38 caliber revolver from about 8 inches away. And luckily, he was in the business of manufacturing fashionable bulletproof clothing, which is why I had gone there to write about him. And I was wearing one of his black suede jackets. He made a bulletproof white dinner jacket for Diddy, and he made these bulletproof sort of caftans for the Wu-Tang Clan and for many other people. So I later was talking to some engineers at DuPont, which makes Kevlar, the most famous bulletproof material. And I was talking to them in a, sort of a conference call, and about a half hour into it, I said, "So am I the only person on this call who's actually been shot in one of these things?" And there was this immediate silence. And it turns out that American manufacturers of bulletproof clothing don't test their products on human beings, or not even on reporters, and that they said, in fact, that they don't even refer to Kevlar as bulletproof. They call it bullet-resistant. So I was glad that I had not talked to them before I went to South America, because I enjoyed being shot, and I wouldn't have wanted to let them talk me out of it. The environment has been a more recent, has not been a lifelong interest. It's been something that I've written about over the last dozen years or so, a number of times, along with these other things. And that is what I want to talk to you about. I think the main thing that I have seen is that it's very easy to look busy on environmental issues, and it's very hard to have an effect, especially as we're talking about energy and climate change. There are several difficulties. The first difficulty with climate change and energy is that the problem is cumulative, while the solutions are not. That is, you know, every little bad thing we do adds to the world's carbon load, and yet the things that we do to alleviate that problem don't add up in the same way. I live in a 225-year-old house in Connecticut. We might as well put the furnace in the yard during the winter for all the insulation it has. There's really nothing inside the walls except this very old-smelling dust and dead mice. The heat just goes right through it. But I decided when home heating oil got to be very expensive that I was going to finally do the insulation project that I've been putting off for a long time, and did, and got much better about turning things off and turning the thermostat down and turning off lights, and made a very significant decrease in the energy consumption in my house, easily noticeable in bills for oil and for electricity. But because I did not take those savings and take them out into my yard and put them on the compost heap, I did what all the rest of us do, which is my wife and I reinvested them in a trip that we took to Europe this past fall, which means that I converted, in Connecticut, I converted natural gas into jet fuel. And this is the difficulty with almost everything we try to do with energy. A man that I was interviewing once said that it's like squeezing a water balloon. You feel that you're making it smaller, but if you look at the other end, you see that we're not. On another assignment, I interviewed a chemist at MIT who was involved in solar power, inventing what he calls the artificial leaf. It's a way of using solar energy to split hydrogen and oxygen, and then using the hydrogen as a fuel for people in impoverished regions who have no access to an electricity grid. But he drew a chart for me on on his whiteboard in his office, which was filled with Grateful Dead recordings. He was a total deadhead. And this is my first PowerPoint slide. I just do it with my arm. I'm almost PowerPoint net zero, not quite. He drew the graph like this, and the two axes, one of them is per capita energy consumption, and one of them is per capita gross domestic product. So it's really affluence and energy consumption. And he said it rises at a 90-degree angle. He said it's, as you can view it, either as saying that as our energy consumption goes up, we get richer, or as we get richer, our energy consumption goes up. You don't really need both variables because you're really tracking the same thing. A Canadian academic, Vaclav Smil, who's the author of a number of really terrific books, has said it as, in an email, he said, monies, however inadequately, are measures of energy flows, which are the only real currency in the biosphere. When we think back over all the wonderful things we have, all the tremendous luxuries that add up together to make this extraordinary life that we live in the early 21st century, we're really talking about the benefits of consuming energy, and for the most part of consuming fossil fuels. The great difficulty in terms of climate and energy is that between now and mid-century, the forecasts are that human population will increase by about a third, while human energy consumption, the energy we consume, will about double. These are both just forecasts, but those are probably as good as any. And if you think about energy use doubling and think in terms of renewable energy, you think about taking all the things that we use energy for right now and doing it again, adding that amount again. It's not going to be in wind and solar, which still constitute very tiny, tiny percentages of our, contribute very tiny percentages of our total energy consumption. Most of that new energy consumption is going to be fossil fuels, which means that we are on a path to significantly worsen our carbon problem despite all the things that we are assiduously doing or think we're doing to make it better. The way we usually pose the green question to ourselves is, do we have the will to make a significant investment in wind and solar and other renewables? But what the real question is, do we have the will as a species to leave some very large percentage of the Earth's remaining fossil fuels in the ground forever, untouched forever, which is a different question, and it's one that we all answer no to in many different ways every day. Me, at least as much as anybody. The second, I'm going to have some of this water. The second difficulty is that in the United States, our main strategy, the main official strategy for dealing with this host of energy and climate problems is increasing energy efficiency in every category. Stephen Chu, who was the former Secretary of Energy in the United States, told me that he said with energy efficiency, he said there's not just low-hanging fruit, there's fruit lying on the ground, and there's no downside because as you become more efficient, it's like it's money in your pocket. You make yourself better off as you decrease your energy consumption. But the difficulty is that actually capturing increases in efficiency as reductions in total energy consumption is very difficult, to say the least. And we can see it in over history, over thousands of years, because in many ways, the history of the human race, the history of civilization, is a history of ever-increasing efficiency. We're constantly becoming more efficient, more energy efficient. We have been since we started using energy. And it hasn't caused our consumption to fall, either per capita or in absolute numbers. On the contrary. I was meant to fly here from Connecticut. I ended up driving because of an ice storm, but air travel is a major contributor to both our carbon output and to our consumption of fossil fuels. Air travel, all these numbers are very hard to come up with. They're essentially made up, even though they came from scientists, but air travel currently accounts for something like 3.5% of global energy consumption and something like the same percentage of our carbon contribution to the atmosphere. I had made a statement about that in something I wrote. I think it was in the New Yorker, and Amory Lovins, who some of you may have read things that he's written, he's sort of one of the leading proponents of the environmental value of energy efficiency through his Rocky Mountain Institute. Levins was dismissive of what I said. He said, what you say may be true today, but he said airplanes are going to become much more efficient. He said, you know, just in the next couple of decades, our airplanes are going to become 70% more fuel efficient. We will make those gains through improvements in engine design, in improvements in fuselage design, in the use of more composites in airplane bodies. Wing shapes will change. They've already changed. You see the little flip on the end of an airplane wing. Computer control of flight paths will cause, they're already causing fuel consumption on airplane flights to fall because we can eliminate a lot of the wasteful circling that airplanes do. And he said, for all these reasons, our planes are going to become 70% more efficient. But the reason not to be too excited about what Levin says is that we've run this experiment already. We ran it before because airplanes today are 75% more efficient than the first passenger jets that flew in the early 1960s. And yet, as we know, the increased efficiency of those planes has not caused our consumption of jet fuel to fall, either per person or overall. In fact, it's created the world that we live in now, where we think nothing of hopping on a plane as I'm going to do on Sunday night and fly to London or around the world. We think of ourselves, the world is where we go, and if we fly enough, we even get to take free trips using frequent flyer miles. As with most of our, essentially all of our savings that we gain through increased efficiency, we reinvest those savings in increased consumption. A few years ago, I flew to Australia to give a talk at a state-sponsored conference on climate change, and my share of the jet fuel consumed on my flight was equal to the average total energy consumption of the average human being in a year just from that one flight. I think when people think about flying to Australia, they don't think about, it's not the cost that makes people hesitate, it's the thought of, do I really want to spend a whole day sitting, watching movies and reading books in a comfortable reclining seat? It's nothing for us to go 10,000 miles to spend a week. But the problem with my flight was not that it was inefficient, because it was extraordinarily efficient. If you think about the first international flights to Australia from the United States on that same route, it was in 1958. It was on a Super Constellation, which was a propeller plane. That plane couldn't go there. It couldn't make the trip in one nonstop. It couldn't make the trip nonstop. It had to stop in San Francisco, Hawaii, Canton Island, Fiji, and Sydney. And the fuel consumption was higher, needless to say, than the fuel consumption of the plane that I took. And yet that flight was greener in every way than the one that I did, because even though it was less efficient, it was such a nuisance and so expensive, about a quarter of U.S. median income each way, that if the people flying with me on my plane had to travel to Australia by that method, none of us would have done it. In addition, our extraordinary mobility, our expectation that we can go anywhere we want to, has a sort of a multiplier effect, which is that in addition to the house that I own in Connecticut and the two cars that my wife and I own, I also own fractional shares, like timeshares, in hotels all over the world. I spend, I don't know how many nights a year I spend staying in hotels, but it's like as though I have a second home, little sort of two-thirds of a second home someplace else. Also, all the duplicated cars, all the duplicated infrastructure that's required to support this level of mobility. Amory Levins and other efficiency proponents don't see things this way, and I've gotten into long arguments, I participated in a long email argument that mostly didn't involve me because it went over my head very quickly. But it was mostly among economists in an email chain after a New Yorker story of mine about energy efficiency came out. And the difficulty with energy efficiency is that it's hard for a scientist or an economist to look at the real problem with the real difficulty with energy consumption, because it's very hard to define the problem and contain it enough so that you can really control all the variables. It's not, it doesn't lend itself to the scientific method. It's not falsifiable. You can't look at the whole world and run a reproducible experiment that you can falsify. And as a result, almost all the studies that we have about energy tend to be one input, one output type of experiments or studies. And there are famous studies about household appliances, for example. If I swap my clothes dryer for a more efficient model, what will happen to the energy that I consume when I dry clothes? And it will go down, almost certainly. But that doesn't come close to capturing what really happens when we make energy less expensive to ourselves, which is what we do when we increase the efficiency of our machines. One way to see this, I think, is to reduce the major problem to a one-input, one-output problem by dialing back human history to the sort of imaginary point when, which I'll call Lovin's Land. It's an early civilization where there's only one energy source, which is food, and there's only one human activity, which is growing that food and then eating it. So you imagine this very primitive society where all they do is grow enough food to survive, and it requires all their effort. And they grow it and they eat it. Well, now give those people the wheel. Suddenly, the amount of energy required to grow enough food to keep them going falls. They don't need as much. They're more efficient. They can harvest and move the food more efficiently. They don't need to grow as much to maintain that level of life. But we know that what happens, we know that by the Lovin's formula, what would happen is that the land under cultivation would shrink because people would be able to sustain themselves with less effort and on smaller pieces of ground because they wouldn't need to eat as much. But we know that's not what happens. We know that they would reinvest that efficiency in increased production. Maybe they would begin to trade with other people. The technology would spread. They would have the leisure to make additional technological innovations that they would follow. There's a third difficulty regarding energy and climate, which is that problems innovate too. Environmental problems innovate too. And they usually have better funding than the environmental solutions. We tend to think that technology works only to make things better for ourselves when we look at environmental problems. And we read about all the extraordinary innovations that are taking place, like the artificial leaf, the professor, he was then at MIT and he's now at Harvard. And it's true, there are extraordinary advances take place all the time. Human beings are amazing, and all our lives are, we sit at the pinnacle of an extraordinary succession of really mind-boggling technological breakthroughs. But when we think about the environment, when we think about technology as a potential environmental solution, we tend to forget the other side, which is that there are people who are just as smart, who are just as brilliant, and who are probably even better paid, who are working to make all those problems worse. The very same kinds of technology that have gone to increasing the efficiency of our machines, the devices that we use, my cell phone, my computer, my furnace that's now vastly more efficient than the one that was in my house when I bought it. Those same increases in efficiency have also increased the efficiency of the technology that we use to do things like discover fossil fuels that we didn't even know we had 15 years ago, 20 years ago. When I first wrote about my piece Green Manhattan, which was making the case that the greenest place in the United States was New York City, for reasons I mentioned in a minute, there was a major issue among environmentalists was the concept of peak oil, that that you can track, that if you graph oil, what we call oil production, taking oil out of the ground, you can see as you graph it when it's going to peak and then when that peak is going to decline. And there was a very depressing book that I read by a professor at Caltech called The End of Oil, and was making the peak oil argument that this was all, we were on the downslope or very near it, and all hell was going to break loose. But today, 10 years later, as I uncovered my eyes and look around, the global estimates of global oil reserves are actually higher than they were then. Estimates of remaining natural gas reserves are vastly higher. Our technological genius has enabled us to find fossil fuels that we didn't know we had, and given us the technology to extract them. There's among environmentalists, I think there is sometimes a sort of sense of excitement about natural gas because we've been able to shut down coal-burning power plants and replace them with natural gas, which is, when you burn it, has a smaller carbon impact on the atmosphere than burning oil does, or burning coal. But it's still a fossil fuel. It has taken what little economic muscle there was behind the renewable energy research, and it's made it uneconomical to invest in things like wind, and has, I think, in most ways, been an environmental has not been an environmental benefit. People sometimes say that natural gas will be a bridge fuel that will be our transitional fuel to renewables, but I would bet, if I had to bet, that natural gas, what it will be a bridge to is coal, and that if we ever get to the bottom of our ever-increasing apparent supply of natural gas, we'll ask ourselves what it was exactly that we didn't like about coal back in the days when that was our first choice for generating electricity. It's sort of staggering to think about exactly what our energy needs are. A few years ago, people were given actual nightmares by the big BP oil spill in the Gulf of Mexico. And I remember seeing on the news this just unceasing flow of oil from the broken thing in the bottom of the Gulf of Mexico. This oil just spewing out day after day. But the average flow from that leak, which was 55,000 barrels a day, the United States burns every 4 minutes. The 87-day total from that leak was about 5 million barrels over 87 days. The world goes through that much oil every hour and a half. Our current oil consumption is equal to roughly 1,400 BP oil wells spewing all the time around the clock, 365 days a year, 1,400 of them. So it's not an insignificant level of consumption, and that's just the oil. The main difficulty with trying to solve that problem by, in effect, reducing the cost of that oil to ourselves by making our machines more efficient is that that's not the way things work. As we get better at doing things, we do more things. We don't do them less. Energy is the only factor of production, I think, that people make a serious argument that where as the price falls, we expect as the cost of it to us falls, we expect us to use less of it. No one would make the same argument about employment. An argument that Stephen Chu made to me a couple of years ago when we talked about this, it's sort of the poster child of the efficiency arguments, is that Chu said that the modern a refrigerator that you buy today uses 75% less energy than a refrigerator that was for sale in 1975, and yet it's 20% bigger and costs in real dollars 60% less. And once again, if this had the effect on our consumption that argue that people like Amory Lovins or Stephen Chu argue it to, then surely our consumption would have fallen rather than risen. The effects go in addition far beyond this simple what happens in a box. I think I grew up in a typical family. I remember the first refrigerator that my parents had. It had a freezer compartment that was about this size that fit a single ice tray, because there was always sort of sheathed with this mantle of frost that could never be removed from it. Modern-day freezers are frostless, incidentally, because the interior surface is heated to keep the frost from forming on it. So you're sort of, a freezer is always fighting against itself. When I was in the 1960s, my parents bought a vastly more efficient refrigerator, which actually had a magnetic seal that went all the way around that held it tightly closed. It didn't have a kind of a locking handle. But that first refrigerator didn't go out of service because it moved into our basement the way most people's first refrigerators did, and where it had a sort of second life as a place where we kept leftovers and beer and things like that. My brother's father-in-law has a summer house in Maine where there are three old refrigerators in the basement, all still in service. One of them has been modified by one of his other son-in-laws so that it holds a beer keg, which comes out. There's a dispenser on the side, and the freezer compartment in one of them is used only to keep beer mugs frosty. Today, a gas station that you go into, any of the gas stations that I stopped in on my way here, has more refrigerated storage space than a grocery store did when I was a kid in the late 50s and early 60s. The refrigeration capacity of people at home is not just the lop over the old resurrected refrigerator in the basement or the garage. Our refrigerators are bigger, often so big that we completely lose track of what we have in them and have to clean them out periodically when they begin to smell bad. The hotel room, it's rare to stay even in a cheap motel that doesn't have a refrigerator in it, which is usually either empty or contains only things that don't need to be kept cold, like nuts. And all that, even though Lovins wouldn't say so and Chu wouldn't say so, those are all cumulative effects of our ever-increasing efficiency, not only of the ever-increasing efficiency of our refrigerators, but of our ever-increasing efficiency of our manufacturing processes. And as we make things cheaper for ourselves, we sell more of them. As we sell more of them, they become cheaper. And the technology spreads. And that same technology that keeps our food cold in our refrigerators, it's the same compressor-based technology that is at the heart of air conditioners. Another rarity when I was a child, in the United States in the 1950s, there was something like 83% of American households had no air conditioner of any kind, not even a room air conditioner. My parents, I was born in 1955. The summer before I was born was very hot, and my mother talked my father into buying a single window air conditioner, and that was the first air conditioner. When I was in second grade, we moved into a house that had central air conditioning, but it was so expensive to run that my father refused to run it, and we would throw ourselves at his feet in that Kansas City summer, begging him to turn on this air conditioner that we knew was there, but he never would. Later, he replaced it with a much more efficient model, and we started to run it all the time. And once you start to run it, there's no going back. Today, in the United States, something like 85% of American households have air conditioning, and most of it is central. It's been a complete flip of the percentage from just 50 or half a century before. The United States in mid-20th century the United States now uses to air condition buildings more energy, more electricity than it used for all purposes in the mid-20th century. Just in a half a century, that change has taken place. And like all the increases and improvements like that, it leaks over into other areas. The car that we went on vacation with in when I was 6 and 7 years old was not air-conditioned. It's sort of hard to believe now. Now I think it would be very difficult. You'd have to go out of your way to buy a car that did not have air conditioning. It's not an exotic option anymore. I was in Las Vegas a few years ago where someone described air conditioning or described cars to me as devices for transporting air conditioning between buildings. It's a simple fact that if you work in a building that's air conditioned, an un-air conditioned house becomes intolerable to you almost immediately, and then an un-air conditioned car. So it's something that we carry around with us. When I was a child in the Midwest in the United States, the coolest room in everybody's house in the summer was a screen porch. It was where you went in the evenings to cool off because it had a breeze. In a house that's air-conditioned, the screen porch immediately becomes the hottest room in the house because it's the one that's not air-conditioned. And if you go through those parts of the country where screen porches used to be a part of life, you see now that almost all of them have been glassed in, because once it becomes the hottest room in the house, you want to do something about it. You still want to do it, but you don't want to step out of the unconditioned air in your house. Even if we get to a point in Canada and the United States where we have so pampered ourselves, we've laid down so much pavement, we've made our cars, we've made that we can't even think of more places to drive, our houses have gotten bigger than they can possibly get, they can't possibly, so big that they can't possibly get any bigger. All these technological improvements that we've made, all these wonderful ways that we've improved our lives, don't stay within our borders. They become part of a global market. Air conditioning is a global market. Most of the air conditioners you buy in this country are made somewhere else. In China, room air conditioners have actually been subsidized by the government for purchase in China. And as that technology spread, it becomes cheaper. Spreads. It becomes cheaper and cheaper, and it increases the pressure, not only on manufacturing but also on the energy that we need to run it. Now, what to do about all this? It's difficult because everything that we like about our lives is really a product of all these wonderful things that is the cumulative product of all these wonderful innovations that we've made. And we don't give them up readily. I would live perfectly happily without a fax machine for a long time. And then once I had a fax machine, I couldn't believe that I'd ever lived without it. And spent a lot of time working on a humorous cover sheet for faxes that I would send to people. And now the thought of even having a fax machine, and this was not that long ago, or the first, I remember the first home VCRs, the first home video cassette recorders, it was like $1,500 and it didn't work very well. The earliest videotape machines, the engineers who were working on it at one of the major television networks in the United States vastly improved the resolution of the picture. I think it took something like 4 miles of tape to show a 30-second film. They vastly improved the picture quality by removing the first row of seats in the theater where they were going to demonstrate it for corporate executives, because if they sat farther away, they couldn't tell how crappy the image was. And yet now you can buy a VCR for something, I don't know, like $5 on Amazon. I had to, for an article that I was writing, I had to watch some old videotapes, and we had a VCR downstairs, and I thought, God, it's all the way two floors down. I just ordered one from Amazon and put it in my office, because it seemed like it was more rational to buy one and put it in my office than it was to go all the way downstairs and try to figure out how I was going to watch it and write about it when I was down there. In the same way, our phones, I've heard people talking about, you know, God, my cell phone that doesn't even, the battery doesn't even last all day. Why don't people do something about the battery? If you went back and used a phone, one of the early cell phones, you would be surprised to discover that it would keep a charge for probably a week with a much worse battery than your iPhone has right now. And the reason is, I had one, I bought a little phone for an international phone. I was traveling abroad, and I didn't want to be tricked into using data, on my smartphone when I was abroad. And so I had this little phone, and I used it when I was in Norway. And I came home, and it sat in a closet for 3 or 4 months. And after that, I turned it on. The battery was still almost fully charged. The reason we've come close to probably what we can do with small lithium-ion batteries, but every gain that we've made, we have captured as an increase in performance. We've added features to our consumption, and none of us want to go back. I want to show you a couple of things, and then I'll answer questions. But I have the world's shortest actual PowerPoint presentation, and I've even made it even shorter sometimes by giving it without the slides. But I do have the slides. We'll see if I can. Oops. This was a picture that was made by the Transit Authority in Tampa, Florida, a number of years ago. They were making a case. They were trying to make a public case for building a transit system in the Tampa area. And this photograph is staged. These are all, they staged this photograph. But, everybody recognizes that this is a typical Montreal traffic jam, rush hour on the way to work in the morning. The second slide is of all the people who are in those cars sitting on chairs in the middle of the same street. And the point that the Tampa Transit Authority was making was that we use an extraordinary amount of technology and fossil fuel and steel and aluminum and everything else and infrastructure, asphalt, to move a very small number of people around. And this is a powerful image. And if you keep it in your mind as you drive on a highway and you sort of think in terms of busloads, it's pretty amazing. But what the Tampa people didn't say, and what I don't think anybody ever says when they look at these slides, is that if you're one of the people who are sitting in one of those cars, this looks like nirvana to you. This is your commute problem has been solved. All those other people who are in your way getting to work are now gone. They're all in a bus, and you have open road ahead of you again. And this is the problem with when we try to solve this problem in this way. Traffic congestion is not an environmental problem. It's a driving problem. Driving is the environmental problem. And if we merely address it by solving the driving problem, we've not only haven't solved the environmental problem, we've made the environmental problem worse, because all that empty space will fill up again with cars, and then you have not only the cars but also the bus in there. So the next step that nobody ever wants to take is removing that asphalt. You move people into the bus, and then you eliminate the road capacity that allows the induced traffic to come back. But that's a much harder one, and that's where our efforts often bog down, and it applies across the line, really. And finally, if I can, I talked about when I was shot in Bogota, and here it is. Okay, are there any questions? I didn't bring my bullet, but I have it. If anybody does have questions, there are microphones on. There's one in the middle and one on this side, and there may be one over there too. And I'll think of a question if nobody has one. I'll ask you a question. Oh. Oh, yes. The question had to do with Manhattan, and what the article that I wrote for the New Yorker, it began. I said my wife and I had gotten married right out of college, and that we had spent 7 years. We were young and idealistic, and we'd spent 7 years living in a utopian environmentalist community in New York State. That we'd had no car, we'd lived in a very small space, we had no major appliances to speak of, that we did all our shopping on foot, and when we needed to go anywhere, we used public transit. And then I said that utopian community was Manhattan in New York City. And the thing that I think that the mistake that we make when we look at cities, and Montreal is another example, is to look at a city and see, you know, this is on a square meter basis, a city is a dirty place. It's, you know, it's all concrete and diesel fumes and trash and garbage and bad smells. On a per capita basis, a city is a very intelligent way to organize human beings to reduce the impact of civilization. New York City, Manhattan residents, 71% of Manhattan households don't own even one car. 54% of New York households overall don't own even one car. Those that do own them don't use them the way I do in Connecticut, where you can't go anywhere without a car. I live across the street from a nature preserve in a recycled 220-year-old house on a dirt road, and my life is an environmental nightmare. Somebody who lives in a city is just by nature of living in the city limited in that kind of impact. Half of all the subway stops in the United States are in New York. The metropolitan New York area accounts for something like a third of all the public transit passenger miles that are traveled in the United States every year. It's these big numbers. And the reason they're big is that it's an organization of human beings in which it is impossible to behave in the way that we do when we have the opportunity to do it. I think it's 15% of households in North Dakota in the United States have five or more cars, which is sort of at the other end of the scale from a city. Now, it doesn't mean that's not an answer to every problem, but certainly when we talk about things like public transit, it doesn't make any sense. It doesn't matter there's no point in talking about public transit if we're not also talking about organizing ourselves in ways that make public transit make any sense at all. It's very hard to make in North America, it's very hard to organize people in a way where the automobile is not necessary. There are only a few places. And Montreal has one of the significant advantage. Most of the places in the world where you see low per capita energy use are places where there was some geographical or natural constraint to outward expansion. Montreal's on an island. It's a pretty big island, like Manhattan, Hong Kong Island. Downtown Boston's on almost an island. It's a peninsula. Same with downtown San Francisco. Where I grew up, Kansas City, which the Sierra Club says has the highest, the most road miles per capita of any place in the United States, it has spread across. There's nothing in any direction to stop it until you get to the Rocky Mountains, 600 miles to the west, and the Gulf of Mexico to the south. And that's where it's going. The places that were out in the country where my friends and I used to go to do bad things when we were in high school are now so far in town, they're almost downtown. There are people who live there who've never even seen the part of the city that I grew up in because it's so far away. Yes, sir.
If your talk isn't really about the problem of liberty and a misunderstanding of liberty, that people can do whatever they feel like whenever they want to do it without some conception of fair share of Earth's carbon-absorbing capacity and things like that. And so it's really a rather resounding indictment of America and the North American lifestyle that you've offered, it seems. I just wondered if you'd comment on that.
Oh, yeah. Well, we're definitely the big appetites at the table, and the most of the, there are a lot of ways that you can, there are a lot of simple first-year economics ways that you can push down energy consumption for example, you make it more expensive. But how you do that, it is a global problem. And how you make energy more expensive for people like us, assuming that you could even get away with it, without making life impossible for people for whom it's already nearly impossible, is a huge challenge. I mean, all these things are big challenges. I think one of the depressing things about if you go to in recent years, I've gone to a number of environmental conferences, and if you made people put away their phones so that you and hid all the other markers of what year it was, it would be very hard to place. It gave everybody the same hairstyle. It would be very hard to place that conference in time based on just what people are saying. There were people in Cambridge, Massachusetts in the 1970s who were giving essentially the same talk on solar energy that you can hear, that I heard a couple of weeks ago at the University of Pennsylvania in 2014. I think that as people who care about the environment, we spend too much time saying things that we basically agree with to people that we basically agree with. And not enough time doing. I don't know what the alternative would be, but there's a lot of. If you go to the Aspen Institute, for example, to the Aspen Environmental Conference, it's you don't need to go more than once because it's pretty much the same, even the same people over and over again. It's a little vacation in Aspen for people who sort of tell themselves the same story over and over again. Meanwhile, the thing that I really think about, spend most of my time thinking about, is playing golf. So, I don't want to give the impression that I'm standing here shaking my finger at North American consumption patterns. Yes, sir.
Yeah, I think what you just described and part of your answer there was pointing at a failure of public policy. And you know, there's parts of the world where. The idea that we should put a price on carbon, an escalating price on carbon, and also eliminate subsidies to the fossil fuel industry are actually being done. And there's jurisdictions in the world that have similar economies in terms of size, GDP per person, that sort of thing,
yep.
With a quarter of the carbon footprint that U.S. or Canada has, or even within Canada, you know, Quebec, people don't realize this, but we in Quebec have a carbon footprint that is one quarter that of Alberta per person. So, on the other hand, we have a lot of economics that tells us if we put a proper price on carbon and escalate that price, and do a number of other regulatory actions, this will go a long way towards solving the problem. The IEA has, the International Energy Agency, has a lot of modeling that shows this. Here in Canada, we have models from Marcia Card at SFU. So it's really a political problem because the problem really is that there are concerted interests that don't want to admit that this is a problem at all. And that's what's really in the way. I mean, the U.S. or Canada could put in proper climate change policy tomorrow if it weren't for the concerted efforts by the fossil fuel industry to block this. So I find it, my comment would be, why isn't this part of the problem that you describe in your speech? Because to me, it's the obvious elephant in the room,
right,
of why this is not happening. It's not, in other words, efficiency is part of the answer. Efficiency by itself, as you show, can't do the whole thing. It needs to be paired with proper public policy, and so that efficiency gains are decouple economic progress from the growth in carbon emissions.
Right. Now, I think that's the trick, and it's not a simple policy matter, even though it must seem on paper to be. When we look at the United States, for example, our inability to deal with a national problem that everybody agrees is a problem, healthcare in the United States, and it's relatively, as problems go, it's an easy one because
But the problem is that we don't agree on this problem, climate change. It's not correct to say everybody agrees what the problem is, and that's because there are economic interests that have fought assiduously to make sure that we don't have the same understanding of the problem.
I think
maybe you could speak to that a little bit, and what you think the solution to that is.
Yeah, well, I'm not sure. I do think that there are definitely people who are ignorant of who are willfully ignorant in some cases, and then just simply ignorant on climate and energy and a whole host of environmental problems, and have no sympathy for any of it. And I've been talked to by lots of them, but I think there are lots and lots of people who basically do understand all these things and have sort of compartmentalized it for some reason. I think it's such a huge problem. I know a lot of college-educated people who are perfectly capable of understanding the science and have watched all the NOVA episodes about it and read about it in the science section of the New York Times. And if you ask them to rank their leading political issues, it would be 20th, 30th. It would be very far down the list. I don't know what the solution to that is. I said earlier today that I think that the only optimistic environmentalists that I know are the ones who believe in nuclear power, but I could add also the ones, it's the carbon market also, nuclear power and people who believe in carbon trading. And I'm not saying that I don't. I just think that I don't disagree with you that it's a policy problem. I don't know what the... what I would say to people is, don't think that by celebrating, by halting the Keystone Pipeline or celebrating the apparent move in the United States to increase fuel efficiency requirements for trucks, that you're having any impact at all on the climate issues, or by planting vegetables in the yard next to a building at McGill.
To answer that, because in fact there are many oil executives in Canada who are on the record as saying if the pipelines don't get built, they will have to cut back their production of oil, and that would mean, you know, so it's part, it's not correct to say that ramping back the infrastructure, fossil fuel industry infrastructure, will not help the problem.
If that oil doesn't find a way to market, true. But if we now trust oil industry executives when they say that they have to have this, there's no other way to get that oil to market, you know, I might disagree.
Well, I mean, there's a contradiction there. So, you know, sometimes they say they need it, and then when people say, oh, well, then don't have it, then we'll reduce oil, they'll say, oh, well, we'll just do it a different way. So, but fundamentally, the issue is that you have a lot of Republicans in your country, and there are conservatives here too, who don't really believe this is a problem.
Right.
And until that changes, and until the people who, many of whom are running the economy, change their attitude. I mean, if somebody sincerely believed that climate change was a problem, They wouldn't ramp up the oil sands by three times from current, I think people who talk about this problem need to say clearly that these people are blocking progress on this issue. And so why can't you come out and say that? Like, you have, you can say, well, there's a lot of people who know the problem but don't know what to do about it. But there's a lot of people who deny there's a problem, and they control the House of Representatives in
your
country.
Oh, no, certainly. But we're complicit with them. They didn't come from anywhere, from nowhere. They don't land from outer space. We put them in office. We buy the products of those companies that we claim to detest.
Yeah, but you have a platform, and why aren't you? That's why aren't you personally speaking out about this? That's what I'm. That's the question I have for you.
I have been speaking about it. I don't know.
Well, you didn't mention it at all in your speech, so that's why I'm asking.
There are a lot of villains. I don't know. I don't know. I don't have a good answer for you. And even if I did, I don't have a good answer for you. It's not because I'm in bed with oil interests or work for an oil company.
I didn't say that. I just said
they're
not identifying real issues.
Okay. Yes.
You hear about people every so often that are afflicted with a serious illness, and they're able to dissociate themselves from the illness, and they say, I'm not going to let the illness define who I am or how I live my life. And I think if you think about consumerism is it's a cultural tool that we've internalized, we've been kind of infected with. And I'm wondering if we think about the problem in that way, can we start to look for the sources of the infection and address, you know, like I think universities are pretty good at spreading the illness, you know, and it starts in kindergarten, or it starts by watching Sesame Street, or I don't know. Do you think that's too ambitious, or is there any?
I don't know. I don't think it's too ambitious. And I think university students are these are the sort of, as demographics go, are the greenest. You're the greenest you'll be in your life. You live in a very small space. You eat very efficiently with friends. You don't have enough money to do anything that causes a whole lot of damage. You don't have cars. You walk to work. You will, until you are my mother's age and living in an assisted living facility, where they live like college students but with much quieter parties. Your impact will not be as small. So I think there is a universities can be, but I think there's a lot of potentially, you know, a lot of the anger that the gentleman behind you is talking about, we, instead of directing it in ways that we make ourselves feel, there are lots of things that we do that make ourselves feel better, that we sort of forgive ourselves for this huge environmental problem without, we shift our consumption into a different gear without changing the outcome. It's sort of product substitution rather than, I'll buy a different car. And I think that's pretty, if you, sustainability in most people's minds, you think sustainability, you talk to people, it's pretty much the way I live right now, but with a different car, probably. I'll buy a more efficient car. And maybe I'll buy local food, I'll buy locally grown food. But you don't see this grassroots transformation of I'm going to work less, I'm going to make less, I'm going to earn less, so I will be, my will shrink the economy by half of my current income. You don't see a lot of people volunteering to do that. Yes, sir.
Would you like to comment on the fact that, or what appears to be a fact, that people will buy gasoline regardless of whatever the price is? The consumption doesn't go down because the price goes up. In fact, governments have learned how to tax gasoline to a great extent, and people still buy it. What is your take on all of that?
Well, there probably is a breaking point, but people, it is like having an illness when you're talking about where you gradually get used to it. And I think people will make a lot of sacrifices to drive. I know a New Yorker colleague of mine, the son, when he was 10 years old, he was looking depressed and sort of gloomy and kind of slumping around in the kitchen. And she asked him, "What's the matter?" And he said, "I wish I had a car." It's a powerful thing, and I think people are willing to make significant sacrifices to keep it. So I don't know. It's certainly not, you know, it's certainly in the United States, I don't know what gasoline is in Montreal, but it's like $3.60 at home. And that's definitely not the point where people feel pain. So I don't know what the price would be. In our two countries, though, even if you price it, it should be more expensive than it is, but it would be a very different, you can see why we even if we think we want our politicians to
save us from this problem, why we tend to vote people out of office if they would, nobody would run for office advocating $10 gasoline, for example. That would be the last you'd hear of that person. Yes, Professor, or yes, ma'am.
Sure. Hi, I'm Kristen. I'm a student in the McGill School of Environment and also a member of Divest McGill, who has a couple members here today. So you said the question is, do we have the will to leave some very large percent of the Earth's remaining fossil fuels underground? And so the student-led movement for divestment from fossil fuels recognizes that imperative to keep like 60-80% of the fossil fuel reserves that we currently have in the ground to stay under 2 degrees Celsius of warming. So we're aiming to do that basically through asking our universities to divest, which the larger goal of that is to remove the social license of the fossil fuel industry to operate and continue extracting the fuels that are basically fueling climate change. So my question is, do you see this as a possible way to kind of generate the necessary will to keep the coal in the hole and the soil, the oil in the soil, as we say?
Yeah, maybe so. Maybe. I think even more would be, you know, I think there's probably, there should be some more direct way. It's a very easy thing to ask for. It doesn't involve not doing anything on our part. So not that there's anything necessarily sanctifying about sacrifice, but I think that it's probably harder to keep oil, coal, and natural gas in the ground than doing that. But you know, I think anything that makes people interested, probably, this is something that the professors talked about, that just creating a frame of mind where you then become receptive at some point to doing something more drastic is probably has environmental value. But I don't think it's a bad thing to do, but I don't think the oil companies will fall to their knees and beg our forgiveness, I don't know. Yes, sir.
I enjoyed your talk, and I should admit I enjoyed chatting with you over lunch as well today, but I want to put you on the spot again.
Last question.
So first of all, maybe as a way to start off, we actually know quite well, after countless studies looking across differences in geography and over time, that increasing the price of gasoline does decrease the consumption of gasoline. So the elasticity, we'd say, is about minus 0.6 on the long term. People can't make an instantaneous adjustment on a six-month time scale because they've already bought the car and chosen where they live and so on, but they absolutely do on the long term. So similarly, if you look at all the models of a good climate policy, as has already just been discussed, it's a package of, if you like, price effects, so limitations on say, the amount of energy that's used, along with energy efficiency improvements, which are somewhat natural if you just put those restrictions in place. They'll carry on happening, as you said, they always have. So you can frame all those energy, all those efficiency improvements as just a happy story in which people can manage to consume well, even in a carbon constrained world. So my question then is about the choice you've made to separate these two ideas and talk about one without the bigger picture. Right? And so to put it maybe sharply, if you ask why is there not support for the more stringent top down policy part. Well, one reason is because the interests that are fighting against the oil interests, if you like, do the normal thing when they oppose anything. They start out with ignoring it, then they move to denying it, which you made reference to, and then there's often another step, which is to say that there's no choice, it's inevitable, right? And so if you can make people despondent, they also won't act and change. So my question is, by coming out and focusing on the fact that energy efficiency improvements and people's goodwill to make change doesn't have any effect or even has a negative effect, aren't you actually encouraging the helplessness or the despondency, which is in fact part of the package that that is in the way of getting set of effects is in the way of getting to the package policies we need, which are, yes, to encourage efficiency, but to do it under the umbrella in which emissions cannot go up?
That seems reasonable. I don't think that the increases in efficiency in the United States, for example, are part of a package. It is the package. It's certainly the way it has been is in terms of public policy. It's always been that is the strategy. And I think it's because it's so easy to sell. So I don't know. I mean, yes. I mean, I'm guilty of anything, as you are. I mean, just as the in the same way that in that sense, yeah, sure. Just as any scientist is who talks about negative effects, or any economist is who talks about policy solutions that people are reluctant to take up. But I don't think it's, I think the reason for talking about these things is that with all the smart young people who are going to save us, I think it's worth looking at the problem whole and channeling energies into paths that are likely to have an effect, rather than, sort of spinning the wheels, doing things that don't have the things that you and I talked about, that have no, the personal acts that have no impact on the problem. Yes, sir.
Hi, my name is Carlos Yanes. I'm an undergrad at McGill School of Environment. I'm a major in environment. And my question is about inequality. And about inequality in economic development 101, one curve that comes up very often is as you get richer, you reach a point where, your consumption and your impact on the environment grows, and then you reach a point where you're rich enough that it starts to come down. You start paying carbon dividends or things like that, and it comes with its own debate that where some say we don't have time, all of us, to get rich in Canada or in the world, and then to slow our impact. I just want to ask, because your argument is that it just doesn't go down. Consumption goes up as we gain efficiency. So in this picture, how do you see inequality of wealth and consumption where one gains efficiency? Do you see more, in other words, do you see more some demographics, consumerism, overriding some of the others?
I'm not sure I completely understand the question, but I agree that especially on a global basis, that there are huge energy equity issues, and there are hundreds of millions of people in the world who should be consuming fossil fuels, who aren't, who should have access to energy that they don't have. And any policy that we somehow agree globally to enact takes care of those people. The only place it can come from is from people like us. I don't know. I don't think I'm being evasive when I say I don't know how that takes place. I don't know what the tool is that lets us do this. And on a very small, much smaller scale, if you bring it down and you see there has been. At least in newspapers, there has been a sort of a return to the cities. There's been a kind of an urban rejuvenation. People are more interested in living in cities. Typically, people get to be about my age, and their children are grown and they're gone, and they see the sort of Jane Jacobs attractiveness of denser urban living, and so you have a huge amount of basically people moving into inner cities where affluent people have not lived in a long time. But there's an equity issue there too. What happens to the people who were living in those places who are not? When downtown Montreal becomes extraordinarily attractive to affluent people, what happens to the people who were living there when it was unattractive? When it was affordable. And we don't solve any social problems if we, for example, on this is looking at a big problem on a very small scale, if we simply reverse the suburban flight of the 1950s by instead of confining the underclass in crumbling inner cities, if we confine them in crumbling former suburbs that we no longer serve in the way that we did before. And then you can scale that problem up to the world, increasing the gap between the haves and the have-nots by orders of magnitude as you try to address that problem there.
Yes.
Hello. Thank you very much for this talk. For me, it's very, very interesting. I'm a professional in environmental issues. And although I earn my living working on these issues and trying to render different things more efficient, I did recognize, and we all do recognize this in the field, that we have a major obstacle to our work and to achieve our goals. And that's actually, for me, that's human nature. And I think everything that you are saying so far, all the examples you gave, come back to that human nature of ours where, for instance, if I go back to your example on the Lovin's Land.
Right.
I didn't know that...
it's not officially known as that.
Okay, good. So anyways, the idea is we have something and then somebody wants to take something from us because we do get more technology, but it means that we can lose some of the potential of that technology. But when you get the wheel, you have that potential with it, and nobody wants to leave anything such a potential. And actually, there are studies that show that this is, in upper mammals, this is something instinctual. We cannot handle losing something we already have. There are experiments, and you can find, even on the net, experiments with monkeys. One, you give an orange to a monkey every day, he's very happy. You give an orange to a monkey every day, another monkey is very happy. Then to the second monkey, you give a second orange for a while, and then you take one orange back. And what do you think? The monkey is not happy after you take the second orange, although it's been eating one orange for a week before.
Yeah. No, it's very similar. Okay. People are not bothered by the fact that they were dead before they were born, but they're immensely bothered by the fact that they're going to be dead after they die. You would think that they would be equivalent states, but we don't interpret it that way.
So one of the things I think happens usually when we want to work in this environmental studies is that we always think about the tools as being magical wands that will make things go away, problems. And usually we ignore the actual problem, which is just standing not just in front of us, but in us, because we are the tool handlers. And if we can use a stick to lift the world, the old Archimedes were saying, or you can take the same stick and beat the hell out of the world. It depends on how we use those sticks. And I think because we are still ignoring this fact that human nature is the flaw and we have to find solution to our human natures, we are just beating around the bush. It's like we're in denial. We're still looking for magical solution for... We're not looking for the sky anymore, but now we're looking for the scientists. But the scientists are not God. They're just going to pop out tools. We have to learn how to use them in a decent way. And we have to learn who we are. Thank you.
Okay. Yes. Yes.
So it's clear we need to decrease consumption, and I was wondering, who do you think has the most power and influence in decreasing this consumption? Is it the consumer themselves that votes with their dollar and ultimately gives the producer their revenue? Or is it the producer that can use that revenue for lobbying and advertising to influence consumer behavior?
Oh, God, I don't know. There are economists lurking who can... maybe talk. It's very difficult. There's an environmental economist that I quote in the book, who, just to completely move the question away from what you actually asked, who talks about efficiency, and this is if we shrink our impact impact in the world, then efficiency, increases in efficiency, can enable us to recapture some of the comforts that we had before we impose a sacrifice on ourselves. But if we lead with efficiency, if we try to make ourselves, if we just focus on efficiency, we never catch up. It's always an elusive target. I don't know how we do it. Actually, I do know. I mean, in 2008, the world did something that no environmentalist had expected. The global fossil fuel consumption and carbon output actually shrank by significant amounts. But the reason wasn't that we suddenly had attained a green consciousness. It was that oil had gotten to $150 a barrel, and the global economy had imploded. There are tools, but those tools do lots of damage with them, and I don't think that
I don't think we know exactly how we apply globally tools that we don't even necessarily know how to apply on a much more local level. 9 billion people by mid-century is an astonishing variation in impact and level of affluence and impact on the world, and how we manage that whole group, or what or where we stand to do it. I don't know. I don't know. That's such a terrible answer to your question. Yes. Nobody should feel that they have to stay, by the way, because I'm happy to stay as long as people want to ask questions, but until Shannon says no, but 10 minutes. Yes, sir.
Hi, my name is Thomas. I'm at McGill in the School of Environment. I'm minoring in economics also. And I want to thank you, first of all, for coming and talking about this, because I think the more people that are like you fostering discussion about these issues, the faster we can start moving on them. I just like to go back to, you brought up at some point the idea of environmental issues as sort of like an illness that we're overcoming and that we're getting used to living with. So I'd just like to kind of like posit, like, what if we look at like environmental issues in a different light, sort of as being like an opportunity to learn something about ourselves and about our society? And I mean, inevitably we were gonna hit a point where we couldn't just keep doing more and more things. Like, the earth is only so big, right? So I was kind of thinking, like, consumerism and, you know, economic growth has not always been the end goal of human society. So, like, I mean, the concept of gluttony used to be something like, you don't want to be taking too much. It's not a healthy thing for a human being to be doing. So would looking at it this way sort of, could you see this as potentially bringing us out of that dichotomy of like doing what we want to do or doing what we have to do?
Yeah, I mean, maybe it is ultimately kind of a spiritual question. I think the illness metaphor was somebody else's, but it's like that, and it's sort of like a chronic illness as opposed to an acute one. And when you break your arm all at once, you deal with it immediately. When something is pecking away at you, you sort of get used to it by degrees, and I think that's a difficulty with very long-term problems that like climate change, where it's not the kind of problem we're good at solving. I think if we suddenly knew that there were an asteroid speeding toward the Earth, and that in 30 years it was going to strike a glancing blow and have some horrible impact on the Earth, you can imagine all the Earth's people. The greatest minds from all the countries, from Iran and Iraq and from the United States and Canada, all getting together to solve this problem. You can easily imagine, because the problem is so focused and so easy to comprehend, and the danger is so specific and so easy to comprehend, you could see the kind of investment, you could see the human race making the kind of investment that it would take to make actually put the brakes on climate change. But because it's a different kind of problem, because it isn't that sort of problem, it's much harder. I think it's much harder for us to rally ourselves to do anything about it. I don't know how that gets overcome. It's a bad kind of crisis in that it takes a long time to unfold. And also, I mean, it's one of the great things about the human race too, is when we do have when there are sort of acute moments that we can attribute to climate change. I won't include the cancellation of my flight yesterday in that, but when we have problems like that, we very quickly get beyond them. I mean, there are people rebuilding houses now that were wiped out by a recent hurricane, you know, in the same place. Their houses were swept away by hurricanes, and you think, what more, you know, sort of personal wake-up call, right to their, you know, it's not even in the abstract. It's right their own house that was swept away. It's part of our amazing resilience as a species. It's why we've done all the cool things that we've done. But it can sort of get in the way of our, you know, solutions to more difficult problems. Yes, ma'am.
Hello, thank you. I enjoyed your talk this evening. I have to admit, I think it was better having you here in person instead of on a screen from Skype, although that might have been much more environmentally conscious. Personally, I came from a house that's bigger than my husband and I need and drove partway in a car that's bigger than I need. And I did take public transport for part of the way, but that's only because I was too cheap to pay for parking downtown. And that may be a key to how to get people to cut back. You mentioned more or less curling into the fetal position after reading the end of Oil book and your nightmares after seeing the broken pipeline mm-hmm. Off the coast. I'm wondering, as someone who, as I've already admitted, has some faults in too much consumption myself, the basic things that I've managed to do are maybe carry my own clubs and only turn on the air conditioning when it hits 30 or above. What have you managed to do anything, or what gives you good dreams as opposed to nightmares, other than an evening where people like this gather together to talk about the situation?
I'd say it's probably a fairly short list. My wife and I don't have any air conditioning in our house. So we don't even have and last summer it was really hot. But everything that we save from that, we find other ways to dispose of that income. I also carry my clubs, but I also carried them with me to Australia when I went there to speak on climate change. So if you want to see a really big carbon footprint, check out Bill McKibben's travel itinerary sometimes. I mean, he goes a lot of different places. And this is, I think, it's another difficulty. We all think that what we do is reasonable, at least, if not important. And so you think, well, maybe couldn't we have an international climate conference that didn't actually involve people going to it? But, you know, as you know, it's hard to do. It's hard to do it well. I did give a talk in Australia where I wasn't in person, but it was done not by Skype, but by some teleconferencing thing, and there was a 5-second delay in the sound, so I couldn't tell. It was very spooky to have no idea exactly what something's going on. And then there was a discussion period after when there was a stage that four people were sitting on the stage, and then my head, which was the size of the entire rear wall of the building, was looking over. This was early days in teleconferencing, and it was really, I don't think it was very effective. But even there, with the things that we do by teleconferencing, videoing this talk on their phone and sending it by satellite around the world to hundreds of different people. We have this invisible sort of energy suck that we don't even really think of the energy cost of all the billions of photographs now that I don't print them on paper, but I store them on servers, and I don't even know where. I don't know where they are. They're someplace. I think that like everybody, I do things my wife and I put out our recycling, and I perversely feel that I've done extra if it's a big pile of recycling, even though this recycling should be very small, would be the ideal. I remember seeing in Beijing, seeing people who set out their recycling. It was just this tiny little thing. Oh, they're really not trying. But it was because there was very little waste in what they were doing, whereas we're capable of putting out quite a lot. So I don't know. I think I'm sure I'm worse than just by virtue of living on the other side of the border, I'm sure I'm worse than anybody here. Yes, sir. This will be the last question.
All right. Try to make it good.
Okay.
So it's mostly about, I think education could be a big component in this. And what do you think about maybe educating the youths and starting young? So if we communicate to kids how bad it is and how, even if you're more efficient, it doesn't necessarily mean that you're helping the environment. If we could communicate that to them, that they shouldn't increase their consumption because of it, I think we could change the consumption habits eventually, and that will in turn reduce our environmental impact and improve
it. Maybe so. I think I don't know. Everybody wants to, if I put another head, everybody wants to put their hands on the curriculum of kids. And so it's a two-edged sword. There are a lot of people who want to get in there, but yeah, I think, you know, and I think that it's probably that the biggest impact on kids is what we do by example, and how and it's hard to set a good example, because especially when all the fun things that are, you know, there's so many fun things that are not. All your children's happiest memories are of things that were probably not all that good for the environment. So I don't know. Yes, children are definitely the hope. I think the environmental education for little kids, for elementary school kids, tends to kind of trivialize everything. It's the 50 easy things you can do to save the earth type of thing. And it's always, you know, put the screw cap back on your Coke bottle and use it as a water bottle tomorrow. I don't think it really pushes the ball very far forward.
And do you think that we could actually change our habits? Like, if people start believing, because let's say deep down everybody has good intentions, if they knew, like, the terrible impact they're actually having. So do you think that we could actually change that by making people understand?
I think you can, but we also have to change the habits of people who have very bad intentions. I mean, everybody has to change. And I think that's where it's difficult. It's why it's difficult to have. You want to be a better person, but we really want everybody to be a better person. And it's like, you know, I think that wealthy people in the United States should pay much more in income tax than they do. I don't think that there's anything that we can do as a society that doesn't, that taxes have been cut back at the upper end. But I would not say, because I believe this, I'm going to contribute $10,000 extra dollars to the United States Treasury. I would support an increase in income taxation in the United States. But it's very, you know, you don't want to be sort of sitting on your suitcase waiting for the flying saucers to arrive. It's a global problem, and the solution has to be global too. I think that's what's difficult. And on that terribly gloomy note, there was a conference in. There was a little meeting in New York, and I think there was like 14 of us. It was Al Gore, who was working on this book of his that came out, and he invited 14 people to come and talk, give little presentations to him. And there's a lot of things that I think that he's wrong about, but he's extraordinarily well read. He's read absolutely everything. But I complimented him for the weather, which was incredibly hot. It was in the summer, and it was for holding a climate change conference in a completely unironic. Environmental setting where it was the season was hot the way it was supposed to be instead of snowing in June the way it was famously at some conference. And I guess we can also be proud that it was cold yesterday when we were here in the winter, that maybe it means that something's going right, although I think it's supposed to be much warmer tomorrow. Anyway, thank you very much.